We are delighted to welcome the Full Fact team. Full Fact is the UK's independent, non-partisan fact-checking charity. They check claims made by politicians, the media, pressure groups, and other voices in public debate and push for corrections where necessary. They also work with government departments and academic research institutions to improve the quality and communication of technical information at source and campaign for greater transparency in the public arena. I'm delighted to welcome the director here, Will Moy, and other members of the team, Joseph O'Leary, CJ McKinney, and Amy Sippett. The session will last about an hour. There will be time for questions at the end where we'll have mics. So if you can, hold on to your burning questions. We'll have that time at the end to field them. So I'll hand over to Will.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. We're Full Fact. We're the UK's independent fact-checking organisation. We're a group of, you could call us journalists, you could call us researchers. We've been called many things, in fact. Our job is to check the claims that politicians and journalists and campaigners make and to trace them back to primary sources, to assess whether those primary sources are the right sources being used fairly, and then to report that to the public, to voters, and to decision makers, including ministers, including journalists and editors, so that people can make their minds up about the big issues facing the country today. And obviously, perhaps the biggest issue facing the country today is, should the UK remain a member of the European Union? And you can imagine that a fact-checking organisation at this time is a group of fairly tired people. Most of the time, we aim to write about one fact-check a day per researcher. That's kind of our standard rate. So we will be scanning the news in the mornings. We'll be scanning what politicians are saying in the mornings. And we will be thinking, what is the big story of the day? What are the big decisions being made at the moment? And what are the factual issues that those may or may not turn on? And how can we help people make sense of them? And so we'll identify a key claim and try to have an answer to it in time for the key broadcast programs, in time for the end of the day, publishing online, but also going out to the media as interviewees and as briefers to explain what's going on and to help people get the right information to their audiences. So Full Fact was born 6 years ago out of a sense of frustration that I think a lot of journalists share, that it is too easy for unsubstantiated claims and inaccurate claims to survive and indeed flourish in public debate. There is perhaps too little price paid when claims are wrong and sometimes carelessly wrong, and there is too much difficulty in finding information that you can rely on at the speed at which journalists and politicians and other decision makers and busy voters have to work. So Full Fact tries to operate on both sides of that problem. On the one hand, we're a fact-checking organisation. We will call people out when they get things wrong, and we will ask them to correct the record. And actually, most national media organisations in the country have corrected the record at our request. So has the Prime Minister and other ministers and MPs from other parts of the House, as well as pressure groups and trade unions and charities. So we work across the full range of public debate because actually, as we all know, most of the claims in public debate don't originate necessarily from politicians and journalists themselves. Sometimes they originate from charities and pressure groups and campaigns, and it's only by working across that full range that we can make a difference. So we've been going 6 years, and in that time, we've learned just how difficult it is to produce really reliable and robust information that will be recognised as fair and impartial on very controversial topics to tight deadlines, and then to communicate that with the kind of skill that you guys have to exercise in your daily jobs. And as part of that, we developed a process for trying to make our work as robust as possible, whereby, firstly, a fact check will be written by an individual researcher. And then secondly, it will be reviewed in detail by a second researcher. So every claim and every source will be revisited, as well as the language and the tone of whether or not we are putting the emphasis on the right things, whether we had considered all the right issues. And then in the third place, during the EU referendum, I will review every single thing we put out to make sure that we have a coherent overview of what we have put out and make sure there is balance across the piece, and make sure we are consistently considering the issues we need to do justice to referendum. So as well as worrying about the internal consistency of a piece, as well as worrying about having used the right sources and consulted the right experts, we're also looking for things like, this is a referendum about the next 30 years, so have we put things in context of what will happen not just this year, but actually over the next 30 years? Have we adequately explained where there are lots of different possible legal mechanisms where something has happened? Have we signposted that there are different options? And there is this constant tension that you will know about in trying to do justice to a complex subject, that you almost never will get more than 3 minutes of anybody's attention, and I'm aware I'm overstepping that mark right now, and you have to summarise that issue in that 3 minutes and give people the best you can in the time you've got. So typically we're writing 800 words. Typically if we're doing radio or TV, you're lucky if you get 3 minutes to explain something. And so you have both the discipline of having talked to some of the leading academic researchers in the country about some of these issues, or talked extensively to, say, the Office for National Statistics, and the opposite discipline of then having to talk to an audience and make that make sense and make that seem relevant. So my colleagues are going to talk to you over the next part of the next hour about some of the claims we've been fact-checking as part of the debate, some of the claims that I hope will be familiar to many of you, or at least vaguely reminiscent of something you think you might have heard at some stage, which is perhaps more like the average person's engagement with the campaign so far. We're going to talk a little bit about the lessons we've derived from the experience of fact-checking all of these claims. But let me start with that first question of who is our audience and what do we know about them in these 6 weeks coming up to the campaign. Firstly, I mentioned this is perhaps the biggest issue facing Britain today. Well, actually, once a month, Ipsos Mori do a wonderful poll in which they ask people, what do you think are the biggest issues facing Britain today? And they don't give people a list to choose from. It's a free response question. And they aggregate those answers and publish it freely online. Since 1973, this has been the set of answers, the set of people answering the EU is one of the biggest issues facing Britain today, or as it was the European Community, the common market, and so on and so forth. So zero down here, 50% of people mentioning it at the top. And as you can see, the baseline level of interest in the EU as one of the really big issues of a country is not huge. This is not something that lots and lots of us spend all of our time thinking about. We're relatively unprepared for this referendum in that sense. But what happens is that when you are given the opportunity to make a choice about it, you can see in the late 90s, I have a big argument about should we join the euro or not, which was seen as pivotal by many people clearly. And now, of course, we're getting to the point where we're being made to answer this gigantic question of do we stay in the EU or not. And if you can see the red dots, the four red dots on the end of a graph, you can see just how much attention has spiked over the last 4 months. And I think just this month, the EU has entered the top three of the issues people think are facing Britain today. So, by and large, perhaps we're not that bothered by the EU, but when we're actually asked about it, we are bothered. Are we paying attention? Well, here's another of my favourite polls. This is from Populous, again, freely published. Absolute goldmine and salutary for those of us who work in public debate in one way or another. Every week they ask people, what media stories have you noticed? What are the news stories that you actually remember seeing this week? This is last week. Obviously, the UK elections were up there. Perhaps, surprisingly, they trumped Leicester City and their even more rare occasion than an election in their triumph. The EU referendum, third on the list of stories people noticed, only 11% of people spontaneously citing it. And that's roughly typical of the last few months. So it's consistently up there, but it never spikes to the level that the really big news stories have. So if you looked at the migration crisis last September, for example, I think of the time that famous front cover with the child Aylan, who drowned on the beach, you know, almost half of people were naming that. So 11%, put that in context. This is a story that is getting consistent attention, but it's not a story that everybody is thinking about. So in that world, and in a world in which 80% of us, when asked, said we don't really know very much about the EU, and we feel there's a lack of information, Full Fact and lots of the media are trying to inform the public whilst two and more very well-funded, very energetic campaigns are trying to persuade the public. And it's our job to help cut through all of that persuasion and explain what's going on when they appear to contradict each other, when they talk past each other, and when they make claims that would take far too long to check than most people have. So I'm going to introduce first my colleague Joseph O'Leary, who's going to take you through some of the claims on the economy that we've seen and talk about how we fact-check them and what we've learned from them.
Thank you very much, Will. If you take us to the next slide. Yes, what does this mean for me? This is a question that we've learned to be conscious of whenever we fact-check claims about the EU referendum, and so many of them we see have a pound sign attached. The whole debate about what the economic costs and benefits of EU membership are and what might happen if we leave. What does this mean for me is basically saying, well, I can see a national figure, a number with a lot of zeros on the end, but what reference point do I actually have to make that meaningful, possibly to my decision on how I'm going to vote? So I'm going to take you through two claims, one from either side of the debate, that show these lessons, illustrate them quite well. So on the next slide, we have a recent, or in fact, soon-to-be leaflet on your doorstep from the Electoral Commission. And this is a claim from Vote Leave. This is the page that they have. And it's pretty clear to see what the main claim on this page is. It's mentioned four times. The EU costs us £350 million every week as a membership fee. Now, this claim is everywhere on Vote Leave literature and in the press. Now, in order to understand this claim, imagine when you go to the shops and you buy a jacket, right? Now, the jacket costs £40, but there's a half-price sale. So what did you end up paying for the jacket? Well, you paid £20, obviously. But what if someone is saying to you, but hang on a minute, the cost of that jacket is 40 quid, so you've just paid 40 quid to the shop? Well, you'd say in response, well, no, you've misunderstood. I got a discount. Now, the same applies to our effective membership fee to the European Union. So, ever since 1984, the UK has had a discount, or what we call the rebate, on its contributions to the EU budget as part of our membership fee. The discount is applied straight away, so we never send over the amount we otherwise would have paid. It gets discounted and we pay the discounted amount. So what you can see from this graphic is basically how it works. Take 2015 as an example. Across 2015, £18 billion is what we would have paid into the EU budget without the rebate. But of course we had it. It was worth something like £5 billion to us in that year. So actually, our effective membership fee, what we paid to the EU budget that year, was £13 billion. But on top of that, we also get money back into the UK. And that money that the EU spent in the UK's public sector was worth something like £4 billion, and so reduced our overall contribution to something like £8.5 billion in 2015. So you start from a theoretical 18, you get to our membership fee, close to 13, and then you reduce it down, because we get money back, to 8.5. Now, there are a few things to bear in mind with these figures. The first is that the money we get back isn't entirely under our control. If you think back to that shop where you bought that jacket, imagine getting a voucher back for 5 quid. It's money back, but you don't entirely have a choice where to spend it. The voucher dictates that. And that's what Vote Leave arguments say. They say, well, you could look at the money we get back, but hang on a minute, we can't control where it's spent, so should we really be considering it? Now, when we came to fact-check this claim, we started by realizing, to our surprise, that there's no one single source for information about this. The Treasury publishes its own figures about what the UK contributes to the EU budget, and they describe the rebate as basically this discount. It's something that is taken away from our debits, effectively, And it shouldn't be seen as something we get in return like a voucher. The rebate is just an instant sale. But then we went to the ONS, the Office for National Statistics, who also publishes data on this, and they measure it differently. They have almost the same figures, but almost mind-bogglingly to us, they present the rebate differently. Rather than being this discount that we get on what we send, it's measured as a credit that we get back almost after the event. And this has produced a lot of confusion for obvious reasons. So we realized that a lot of the confusion that's been causing public debate is actually that the very sources that we would rely upon for this information are not consistent. And that's almost the most frustrating thing about fact-checking. It's that sometimes it's not even as simple as finding a reliable source. You have to look at what all the possible sources are saying and work out who's presenting this in the least misleading picture, often. To take a second example, the Remain campaign has recently published its own analysis. And it takes a much broader view. This $350 million a week was talking just about our membership fee to the EU budget. This is a much broader claim about the overall economic impact on the UK. And the Remain campaign has a claim of its own. If Britain leaves the EU, it could cost families £4,300 every year. Now, it goes back to this point. What does this mean for me? First of all, where does 4,300 come from? Well, the Treasury did its own analysis where they worked out how much less would GDP grow by if, say, we left the EU and became a bit like Canada. A relationship Canada has with the EU has fairly free trade in goods but less free trade in services. It's an alternative to a number of different models. We could be like more like Norway or more like Switzerland. But taking this idea of Canada, if we leave the EU and have something like what Canada has, Treasury say the cost of GDP is the equivalent per household of £4,300 every year. Now, effectively, they've divided the change in GDP, the size of the economy, by the number of households in the country. The problem is that actually what families will experience at the end of the day, assuming this analysis is spot on? Well, no, it almost certainly isn't. And the reason for that is that GDP is more than just the sum of households and what households produce. GDP is about what businesses produce as well. The Treasury itself, separately to this, has said that the measure of GDP per household is not a household income metric. So it's almost saying, in that sense, the 4,300 figure is not something that relates to household income or what a family will experience. It's just a big number divided by a small number. And we need to ask ourselves when we see claims like this, and we want to ask this question, what does this mean for me? We have to think, well, is the measure that they're giving us actually indicative of what me or my family will experience? Now, to take the 4,300 figure in another light, is it actually a reasonable analysis? Well, it's almost a red herring to think that a prediction, and this is a prediction, by the way, for I think 15 years in the future, so they're looking at 2030, and they're saying by 2030, the equivalent loss per household is 4,300. And the kind of problem there is people see the precise figure and they either maybe implicitly trust it or distrust it. But it's a red herring because it's almost not as important as the general direction that this research is taking us in. So you might, for instance, go to the doctor and say you want to eat sugar and ask the doctor, so how much will my weight be next year if I do this? And the doctor might say, well, I can't be precise, but it will probably add to your weight. Should we just throw out everything the doctor has told us because he or she was not able to give us a precise figure? Well, no, not necessarily. Sometimes there's validity to giving a sense of direction and showing your reasons for doing that. And that's what our analysis found of the Treasury's document. And it's worth bearing in mind that most economists at the moment seem to agree that leaving the EU would cost the UK economically. The specific amount, as shown by this research and others, is perhaps less helpful. So, two examples, both of which relate in different ways to how do we actually find a meaningful figure to make these numbers make sense. So I'd like to pass over now to my colleague CJ McKinney, who's going to talk about another lesson for us.
Cheers, Joe. So another thing we often see when we're doing our fact-checking is a lot of conflicting claims, people contradicting each other, saying that, no, the thing you've just said isn't accurate, isn't correct, and you have these apparent clashes in public debate. And as a voter, you're sort of looking at this going, well, who's right, who's wrong? Because both sides are saying different things. But actually, what we often see when we dig into it is that there isn't really a conflict. What's happening is that each side is talking about a slightly different thing and that they're both actually right on their own terms. That's a bit abstract, but I'll go through a few examples. The first on control of our borders in the EU debate. Another on how many of our laws come from the EU, which we get a lot of claims on. And the third on whether the deal that the Prime Minister negotiated on the EU in February, was that legally binding or not? Believe it or not, all of these are hot political issues, if you have the misfortune to be paying too close attention. So on control of our borders, as you can see on the screen there, you have Mr. Farage and Mr. Carswell on the Leave side of the debate saying that we don't control our borders in the EU, and it's ridiculous to say that we do. And on the Remain side, you have cabinet ministers saying, of course we control our borders, despite being in the EU. So as a voter who's paying kind of casual attention to this, what are you supposed to make of it? Surely one side is right or the other is right. But not really. What it's all about, as you guys maybe know, is that controlling our borders, controlling the UK's borders, comes down to two things. One is controlling the volume of people that can come in, controlling immigration. And the other is checking the people that come in and turning away people if they are a terrorist or whatever it might be. And this is where you have this apparent conflict, because the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary are quite right to say that we control our borders in the sense that we check people's passports when they come in, and we do identity checks. And if you are a member of ISIS, we'll probably do something about it. But that's not the same as being able to control the volumes of immigration from the EU, which is what Mr. Farage and Mr. Carswell are talking about. We cannot significantly control immigration from the EU as an EU member. So they're also correct. So it all depends what you mean by the phrase control of our borders. And you as journalists might, you know, take a view on that. If you were covering this, you might say, you know, it's, you know, reasonable or unreasonable to use that phrase in this way. We don't. We leave it up to people to decide whether it's reasonable to describe control your borders in the passport checking way or the immigration way. But we'll always give the other side of it as well. So we'll say, yes, Mr. Cameron is correct to say we control our borders in the passport checking sense. But it's also true that we don't control immigration necessarily. And there's quite a good example, actually, on the next slide, Will, of I thought this was quite well covered in this piece in The Telegraph, that this journalist was quite alive to the distinction that was at the heart of this debate. And he really sort of teased out that, you know, while the Home Secretary was talking about control of our borders in the passport checking sense, there's this other immigration sense in which there's a debate. Second example is about the laws that come from the EU. We often get claims about this, and you can see two of them on the screen. Boris Johnson on the Leave side of the debate saying that 60% of our laws come from the EU. And the pro-EU European movement say, no, that's not true, it's 13%. And interestingly, both of them invoke the same source, which is the Independent House of Commons Library, the research service for MPs. So, I mean, clearly, if both of them are saying that the House of Commons Library says this and they're wildly different figures, then someone must be wrong, right? Or someone's misrepresenting this research. Well, again, it turns out not, because what's happened here is that if you go to the House of Commons Library Research, they give a range. And the low end of the range for how many of our laws come from the EU is around 15%-ish, and the higher end is up around 60. So perhaps, understandably, people choose the number they think suits their case from the top or bottom of that range. There are sort of technical legal reasons why there is this range, why this number is surprisingly hard to calculate. I won't bore you with them. But I suppose it's, again, from a voter point of view, if you're paying attention to this for 90 seconds and you just want an answer to the question, well, what are you supposed to think? Which of these numbers is right? You know, which is most accurate? Our take, for what it's worth, is actually this question isn't helpful to begin with, because counting up individual pieces of law from the EU and from the UK and kind of comparing them, it's just not that helpful. Laws are very different. Some are really complex and important. Some are really technical. So actually, if you want to give a voter or someone who's interested in this EU debate a sense of where the EU impacts on this country, you need to look at it in different policy areas. So, for example, international trade or immigration, the EU has a big impact. Health, education, not much direct impact at all. That's the best sense of making sense of this. In terms of those numbers, though, on the next slide, then, again, as an example of someone being quite on top of what was happening with these claims. This is an exchange at the Treasury Select Committee. So Mr. Johnson was being quizzed by Andrew Tyrie, another Conservative MP on the top left. And Mr. Tyrie has in front of him the original research, and he's saying, look, Mr. Johnson, you're quoting the top end of these figures, and actually there's a range. You know, perhaps you should acknowledge that. So onto my third example, which is about this EU deal that was negotiated in February. You may or may not remember it, but there was a lot of fanfare about how the Prime Minister had secured a new deal for the UK within the European Union. And one of the controversies was, well, is this deal worth the paper it's printed on? Is it legally binding? And you have Michael Gove, who's the Secretary of State for Justice, who should know, saying that, oh, no, it's not legally binding at all. And you have the former Attorney General, who should also know, she also knows law, saying, of course it's legally binding. So again, you know, clearly one of these people is misinformed, you might think. But again, if you look at it, to boil it down very simplistically, kind of what's happening here is that, again, they're talking past each other a little bit. They're talking about slightly different things. So that deal was the Attorney General saying this deal is binding in international law. Michael Gove is saying, but it's not binding in EU law. And that distinction is quite, you know, technical and abstract for most people, including me. But that's what's going on there. They both had, you know, a reasonable amount of support for their view. For us, trying to get this across, because it was very technical and involved, we sort of took the view that actually this deal that was negotiated wasn't one thing, wasn't one document that was legally binding or not. Actually, it was lots of different things illustrated on this wonderful graphic here. So actually, what you want to ask is, well, in this deal, what are you interested in? Are you interested in child benefit being sent to children who live in other EU countries? Well, then we can tell you whether the deal is legally binding, whether it might be overturned by the EU court in future. So if you break it down, then you can kind of make a bit of sense of it. More to the point, maybe, this debate about whether it was legally binding, does it miss the fact that this deal was very politically binding? Because the leaders of every EU country stood up and said, well, we will stand over this deal, we'll make this happen. So there's big political impact here, which maybe makes the legal thing a bit of a red herring. And on the next slide, there's an example of that being captured very well in journalism, we thought. So this was the BBC analysis, just making the point that, well, whether there's a legal issue or not, you know, does it really matter in the grand scheme of things? So there are three examples just of claims that seem to be contradicting each other, seeing like, you know, there must be a smoking gun here where one side or the other, the debate is wrong or misleading, but actually their support somewhere in the sources. So I will hand over to my colleague, Amy, who's going to bring us on to another area.
So one of the key jobs that we have as fact checkers is not just thinking about what is being said, but also thinking about what isn't being said. And also thinking about what information you would want as a voter in order to be able to judge each claim. The main way in which we come across this with the EU is in assessing whether something is actually the effect of EU membership, and also asking the question, what would happen if we leave? So many of you have probably heard the claim that 3 million jobs are linked to our trade with the EU. We first came across this claim in 2011. We researched it and tried to trace back where the claim came from, kept finding previous mentions of it, which then linked to a previous mention of it, and eventually we traced it back to research which came from 2000. Back then, it was described as 3 million people whose jobs were directly dependent on our participation and role in the European Union's single market. But the research it was based on didn't show that. It found that there were 3 million jobs linked to trade with the EU. There was no knowing what would happen to that trade if we left. The author of one of the original studies on which this figure was based said that theoretically there was no reason to suppose that many of these jobs, if any, would be lost permanently if Britain were to leave the EU. More recently, he's also commented that the way to think about it is that perhaps these jobs become a bit more vulnerable if we were to leave, but again, there's no reason to say that they would definitely be lost. And even if we left the EU, it doesn't mean that our trade with the EU will be substantially affected, nor that these jobs purely depend on that trade. We and other fact-checkers have been making this point for the past 5 years, and we think it has finally gone through, because since then we've seen it change from linked to our membership of the EU, and now a stronger INS leaflet makes the much more restrained claim that says these are linked to our exports with the EU rather than our membership with the EU. And for information, more recent estimates have put the figure at somewhere between 3.3 million and 4 million. So the point of this example is to ask yourself, is something definitely directly linked to EU membership, or is it linked to something which is part of something we have with the EU, but that isn't necessarily linked to our membership with the EU, and asking what would happen if we left. The other factor that's really important is that the EU referendum vote is often presented as a choice between two binary options. If we leave, it'll be one situation, and if we stay, it's you know, the way things currently are. But either way, it is just not as simple as that. So one example of this is that one of the criticisms of the EU is that we have to accept the EU's freedom of movement rules, which means immigration from the EU. So as CJ touched upon earlier, we can't directly control immigration from the EU. So people who want to leave are saying, well, if we leave the EU, we can control EU immigration. But then, similarly, people who want to leave also talk about wanting to retain some trade with the EU. And, for example, in one of the Vote Leave leaflets, they've cited Switzerland as an example of a non-EU country that still trades a lot with the EU. So, on the one hand, you've got them saying, if we left the EU, we can control EU immigration. We're then also saying, well, we'll still be able to trade with them, and some people saying, well, we'll remain part of the single market. But the single market, in order to be part of that, you have to accept the free movement of people rules. So you can't have one without the other. You can't say, if we leave the EU, we can control immigration, but we'll still remain part of the single market. And this actually has become quite a big issue for Switzerland. So they held a referendum on whether they should introduce quotas for a number of immigrants coming into the country. And that referendum passed, so the Swiss people said, yes, we want to introduce quotas. But now there's this ongoing debate with the European Commission, who say, well, that completely goes against the agreement that we have with you in terms of the trade that you do. So it's just not possible to have one without the other. If we want to avoid these requirements, we would have to leave the single market completely, which some Leave campaigners have suggested. In the same way, the other possible requirement that might come with, if we want to keep some access to the single market, is also retaining some EU laws. So Norway and Switzerland do this to varying degrees, either copying EU laws wholesale or adapting part of them into their laws in return for access to the single market. So the last thing I wanted to mention is that just because we have something in the EU doesn't mean that we wouldn't have it if we left. So the Remain camp has spoken of the benefits that the UK gets through the European arrest warrant. So we opt into this as part of our EU membership. The European arrest warrant enables the extradition of people under arrest to other countries in the EU, and it also enables the deportation of people wanted in the UK back to the UK from other EU countries. So the UK opts into this. It also opts into a number of other security arrangements with the EU, like a security information sharing system and the European criminal record system. So if we decided to leave the EU, we might not be able to access these things directly. So with the European arrest warrant, that doesn't currently apply to countries outside the EU. But Norway does participate in kind of similar aspects to this. So it does still participate in the security information sharing system. It also still has something like the European arrest warrant without being a member of the EU. So it's not the case to say simply that we've got this in the EU. If we left, we will no longer have anything like this at all, because it may well be we could still have something similar. And now I'll hand back to Will.
So there are certainly couple of conclusions you can get from a little whistle-stop tour of the experiences we've been having over the last couple of months when this has been really intense. The first is that you are absolutely guaranteed to be bewildered at some stage, and your audiences and the voters are certainly guaranteed to be bewildered. There is no reason why people have to be bamboozled, though, and the challenge for all of us, I think, is to cut through what sound like plausible claims, what sound like very strong claims, and actually make sense of them for our audiences. And full fact, as well as having our team of researchers, some of whom are here, we also have very strong links to expert organizations around the country. So we're working, for example, with the Migration Observatory at Oxford University on some of the immigration coverage we're doing. We're working with the Nuffield Trust at the moment to do an analysis of the relationship of European Union membership to the NHS and the staffing and other impacts that go on there. And we've worked with a network of EU law professors from all around the country who helped us put together our analysis of the deal and much else besides. So if you want access to expertise, we are more than happy to help you find the right person to talk to. There's a good chance we have already talked to them and can give you a potted summary of what an expert could tell you at great length, if that could be useful. The other great conclusion, I think, is that there is no set of facts which will make anybody's mind up for them. This is not a referendum in which simply doing enough research will tell you what the answer is. But that has done nothing to dent the huge appetite we've seen among the public for information that people feel they can trust about what's going on. And the moment the referendum was formally announced in February, as well as you saw on the Ipsos Mori graph, public interest in the importance of this issue shooting up, public interest in full facts shot up as well. I think our website traffic doubled overnight, and it's grown ever since. There is a real appetite for information people feel they can trust, and it's been great to see lots of outlets coming to us to work with us on that. It's been great to see the BBC put together its reality check team again, which pops up for elections and things, to try to answer some of that demand, and lots of other outlets doing other things. But we are here to help you. So please, if we can help you, get in touch with us. Let us help you find sources, and let us explain things if we can, if you've got questions. And on that note, if you have questions, now's the time. Microphone's behind. You start with the gentleman in the middle.
I just wanted to ask, which side would you say is producing the most misleading information? And is there any value in empirically surveying that?
That's a wonderful question, and it's always nice to get it as the first one. We are not checking everything for sites say, nor are we checking a random or representative sample of what they say. So we can't say sort of this side is 70% right and this side is 60% right or anything like that. What we will be publishing next week is our fact check of the Electoral Commission's booklet, which is going out to every household in the country and which includes a page from either campaign. And I invite you to read their pages and our fact checks and make your own mind up about that question, because those are two clearly comparable things. But I think what you'll find is so many of these questions come down to a judgment about whether you feel that we have control over our borders is a fair description of we can do passport checks, or whether you feel that it's a misleading description of our inability to control the number of EU citizens who come to the UK. That's not a judgment we can make for anybody else. So actually, in a lot of this, we'll be saying, here's the information, and you have to make your own mind up about it. But we are watching the campaigns very closely, and nearer the referendum, we may come out and make our views known if we think that's appropriate. Lady down here, the lady in red, if I may. The microphone's just coming.
I'm a bit concerned that your work is actually underscoring the narrowness of the debate that's going on. So we're actually hearing from two elites all the time. We're not hearing about what people want at all. So the fact checking is only on the claims of those two elites. So especially when you say like how it affects me, well, I think there's pretty high concern of like which would protect the NHS best, things like that. Yeah. Which have we got more chance of nationalising rail? Which will give us better taxing of corporations? Which will keep GM out? Which will sort out the PFI debt so that we're not paying it all the time? This is possibly a higher concern than these. Just what the elites are choosing to focus on. A really big one is, and that they're really using, is look, we can have more trade agreements than you can have in or out. Well, any people that know about the current crop of trade agreements don't want the trade agreements. So that's really contradictory that they're banging on about, look how many trade agreements we can have. When you talked about the rebate, not the rebate, but the money that comes back from the EU, there's the issue of the cap money, but just stopping there is sort of inadequate because there's the distribution aspect of the cap money and how much of the cap money goes to Prince Charles and Duke of this and that.
Let me jump in. I agree with you, and many of the issues you'd named are issues that we are working on. I have a colleague at the moment currently working on an article about what the effect of EU membership is on bees, because bees, the little insects that fertilise plants, those bees. Because lots of people have asked us to, which is a great opportunity to advertise fullfact.org/ask, where anyone can come to our website and post anything they want to know about, and we are working through those at the moment. I think the current top one we're working on is what's happening to the steel industry, and is EU membership interfering with our ability to do something for the steel industry. As I said, we're working on bees. We want to answer the questions that people really have. And one of the sources we're using to understand what people care most about, going back to the Ipsos Mori surveys, they've just published, I think 2 days ago, this updated version of what people are saying are the issues that are going to help swing their votes. And you can see the economic impact at the top. The number of immigrants coming into Britain is second, and then Britain's ability to make its own laws. So you can see that some of the issues that are being raised in what you would call the elite campaigns are cutting through and are things that people are mentioning when asked. And then there are lots and lots of issues that people are coming up with that maybe don't make national interest. So we went out to membership organizations and said, do your members have questions that are interesting to them that we might be able to answer? And we've got 38 Degrees and the Federation of Small Businesses both giving us questions that their members are interested in that we can help answer. So we're doing our best to cut past just what the elite argument is. But it's also important, as all good journalists do, to hold the elites to account, as it were. CJ.
Just to jump in as well, I mean, some of the examples you used about the NHS and the trade agreements, such as the one with America, the TTIP agreement, which is controversial, I think you're right that the sort of elite campaigns, if you like, at the start of the process weren't talking about sort of public services and about TTIP and trade agreements so much. But actually, because we're quite first-ins, quite plugged into this debate, we've seen them come up actually quite a lot in the last couple of weeks. So I think you're right that there are those issues that were being overlooked perhaps initially that are now kind of coming to the forefront. And the NHS, I think, is a big one. So certainly we're trying to adapt accordingly what we're researching.
Gentlemen there.
So to what extent would you say that not only fact-checking the things being said about the referendum, but also encouraging enthusiasm amongst voters that wouldn't would-be voters, I suppose. And if so, are you targeting any specific demographics and how are you going about engaging them?
So your question is, how are we sort of, are we trying to get people interested in the referendum? Well, our starting point, I suppose, is that we would love everyone to be interested in the referendum. It's a really important decision that affects us all. We think voting is important. We are not a get-out-vote campaign, and that would be slightly beyond our remit, so we have to be a bit careful about that. But that is why, you know, we will do, you know, everything from the Today programme to phone-ins and just try to talk to the widest possible audience on the widest number of channels. We are doing volunteering tomorrow. Is it tomorrow? Saturday. On Saturday. All of us, I think, will be in a room in Shoreditch with a group of volunteers updating Wikipedia and trying to make that as up-to-date for people as possible. So we're doing what we can to provide ways to get involved, to be useful, but ultimately we can't be the ones who are saying this is important, you must vote, much as we agree with those who are.
Yeah, I think just again to tack on a rider, the nearest thing I suppose we're doing to that is that if you look at the Google have their sort of top e-referendum questions, what people are Googling. And, you know, similar to what the previous question was saying, it's not about, you know, are 60% fair laws coming from the EU or whatever. It's what is Brexit? When is the referendum? How do I vote? You know, these like these kind of nitty-gritty stuff. So we're going to have answers to them that will hopefully be useful. But, yeah, I guess that's about as close to a get-out-the-vote as we're doing.
Forgive me, I've only just walked in on this meeting, so
welcome.
What I have to ask and to say may have been superseded by what's already come, but I've just been away, here's my doctor's note, excuse, at a meeting about these issues, and I just want to report, the given the nature of the demographic in the room, that the under 35 vote in the UK, many people have said, and I heard it substantiated at the meeting I just come from, is likely to be the deciding vote. This is on the one hand good news in that young people are mobile and active and energetic and so on. It's also bad news in that young people have many calls on their attention and are easily distracted and overloaded with messages and so on. A practical suggestion that was put to us an hour ago, which I think is relevant to this group today, is that broadly the boundaries between nations are seen in different ways by people who've grown up with Facebook and the millennial way of seeing things. And therefore, the young in France and in Germany and in other European countries who have views on this could be engaged, would be willing to be engaged, and would be heard perhaps more by that demographic than your appearance on the Today programme, for example. And I wondered if you have a view on whether there's enough time to mobilize that, rather for somebody of my generation who perhaps might resist being told what to do by the French, for example. rather surprising and long-winded way of getting out the vote and getting people engaged. Whether you've got a thought on this.
Well, one reason why we have to be very careful about talking too much about get out the vote is that our role is educational, and it's not for us to sort of trespass on that territory. And very specifically, we have no interest in the outcome of this debate, and we've been fact-checking for, you know, since the EU referendum was a glint in a very small number of people's eyes, and we will be fact-checking on lots of other topics long after. So we have no stake in the outcome, and as you may know, the outcome and turnout are quite closely linked, potentially. I don't know, Amy, if you want to say anything on either the youth engagement side or the turnout.
Yeah, I know that polling has suggested that the turnout, particularly for the Leave side, I think, could be kind of the winner too, because obviously if you want to leave, you're more likely to turn out to vote, whereas if you just want the status quo, then perhaps, yeah, you're less likely to turn out. I know there has been recent polling in the past kind of couple of days on the younger age group, but I haven't had a chance to look at it in detail. So
you'll see from our point of view, to maintain our independence and neutrality, going too far down the line of, although we support that everyone should vote, going out and getting people to do it in this particular referendum is actually likely to be seen as crossing that line. So we have to be very careful. So lady at the back there.
Apologies if this has been answered as well, but in terms of your own neutrality, as slightly cheeky question here, has anybody questioned that at all? And I know you are educationists, as you say, but has, in some ways, nobody's completely neutral, but has that ever been an issue at all? And also, can I ask your own funding, where that has where that comes from?
Did you catch that?
So yeah. Questioning our neutrality and our funding.
Do you want it, or shall I?
Well, basically, yes, all the time, but people accuse us of being biased on both sides, so I think quite often I'm kind of tempted to show them the comments from the other side accusing us of being biased on both sides. Joe, do you want to talk a bit about funding?
Yeah, so all our, you can find out about our funding on our website, but most of our funding comes from charitable foundations, so we get funding from the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Foundation, the Esme Fairbairn Foundation, the Nuffield Foundation. And we also get a number of kind of individual donations as well. We've currently, as a prelude to the EU referendum campaign, ran a crowdfunder in which we raised, I think, over 30,000.
Over 40,000.
Over 40, yeah. Oh yes. We aimed for 25, then it became 30, and then it became 40. So we were very pleased with that. So we managed to, on crowdfunder.org, really kind of stoke people's interest in getting access to impartial information and signposts to the right places to look for judgments. And so we managed to raise that as well from a number of individual donors as well. But as I say, the details of our funding is always available on our website, and we back that with our Board of Trustees, which is a cross-party board. So we have members of all the main political parties on that board. Anything I missed?
We'd never accept funding from the EU or the government, which was a question someone asked us fairly recently.
Just slightly frustrating, because we reckon we could probably get some. But there we go. I'm hugely proud that actually that our referendum work was funded first and foremost by 1,300 individual donors, and that really matters. But it's been really striking, I think, looking at the online noise and activity, that this debate does seem to be slightly more polarized than normal, what you might call peacetime. It does seem to have echoes of that Scottish referendum phenomenon of kind of reflexive distrust of various institutions. to the extent that the BBC Reality Check put out something yesterday, which I haven't yet seen, and one person was responding to them saying, well, I think I'll wait for Full Fact to check that, to check that it's independent. And I think there's a lot of that kind of reflexive distrust baked into some of the institutions and some of the nature of the debate around the European referendum, and that's been quite interesting to see. And I suppose in a job like ours, which is ultimately about trust and the idea that it should be possible to place well-founded trust in powerful people's statements in public life, any sort of hint that we might be going down that sort of more American, more polarized, less common ground on which people can agree, from which the debate can start, is always something we look at nervously. And this referendum will be an acid test, I think, to some extent, of whether that tendency is really setting in the UK. Speculate. But any other questions? Gentleman up there.
Once your sort of fact check is out, do you follow how it's then used in the debate, at least online? I mean, does it pierce echo chambers which are polarized, or does every side just use you for their own preconceptions, or do you feed into confirmation biases, or do you break some of them sometimes?
So we are less concerned about being used by the campaigns. In this particular context, I mean, in the wider context, we're quoted by politicians of all parties, newspapers of all persuasions, and so on, and that's important to us. But in the context of a referendum, our primary audience is voters, and we're trying to reach them. And one of the nice things online, on Facebook, for example, you get some demographic data about who you're reaching, and there is a genuine spread of both gender and age, which is encouraging, although it tends to a slightly younger audience, as Facebook does. How do we track where our fact checks go? Anyone want to take that?
Well, what I was also going to say is the nice thing that we're particularly noticing recently is that we're signed up to a newspaper archive service, and pretty much every day at the moment we're getting in emails saying showing us letters that people are writing into local newspapers citing us and saying, oh, I've really been struggling to find neutral information about the EU, and I've come across Full Fact. And that's actually really nice. It feels like we really are helping people have this debate about the EU.
That's such a good point, actually. And I think it's Leave.eu who are principally associated with making the case that the real argument in this referendum isn't going on the airwaves. It's going on among ordinary people talking to one another in the real world or online. And being part of that is a critical part of communicating during this referendum. And it's been nice for Full Fact. You know, we've grown gradually. There were only three of us a few years ago. It's nice to get to the scale where we can see ourselves actually being used as a resource at that kind of level. So it's an exciting glimpse of what the future could hold.
It's worth saying as well that this panel is not actually representative of Full Fact's wider team. Don't think of us as a bunch of researchers in a room. We certainly used to be, as Will alluded to, when there were just three of us. But Phoebe Arnold is our senior communications officer, and she manages our kind of correspondence outside Full Fact with key stakeholders. So, for instance, the UK Statistics Authority, who are our watchdog over the official statistics this country produces. She manages our comms with them because we often have reason to flag up misuses of statistics with them and have them step in and play their role. And we also have Meevan Babacar, who focuses on our supporter comms, how are we doing on Facebook and Twitter, and kind of what is our kind of reach and impact there. So there's a whole kind of machinery of Full Fact that goes on, and the research team is just a part of it, which is great.
I think we've reached the end of our time. If any of you have any burning questions, do come and have a chat with us. If we can help you in your work, find us team@fullfact.org or online with Full Fact on Twitter and everywhere else. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.